Thank you very much. And Dr. McDonald, I just want to tell you, I have no idea what I'm going to talk about either, but it'll come out, I'm sure, as we go along. You know, I was thinking about this panel as I was coming in from Miami International Airport this morning, because I used to come to Miami quite frequently because I used to work for a labor union that was affiliated with the American Federation of Labor and Congress of Industrial Organizations, AFL-CIO, and we used to come down every February. This was back in my liberal days. We used to come down every February for the annual meeting of the Executive Council. And so we were down here each and every year. And it used to be when I would come to Miami and I would land at the airport, not only would I hear Spanish spoken all the time when I would come into the airport, but when I would go to buy a soda or go to a restaurant or, you know, pick up a newspaper, if I encountered a non-Cuban sales clerk, they would generally not speak to me at all, and when it came time to tell me how much I was owed, they would usually turn the little money counter, the little indication of how much I was owed around so I could see it, assuming, looking at me, that I didn't speak English. And of course, all the Cubans spoke to me in Spanish, assuming that I spoke Spanish and that I was one of them. Well, I'm not Cuban. In fact, my family is from New Mexico, came in the early 1600s, and I speak no Spanish. So it was very strange. Well, the strange thing about today is that everywhere I've gone, everybody speaks English to me. Now, I think people probably still do assume that, you know, I might be Cuban or some other Latin, because this is the gateway to Latin America's Miamians are fond, some Miamians are fond of saying, but they also assume I speak English. And I think that does say something about assimilation. And I don't know, generally I am not an optimistic, cheerful sort of person. I'm usually the person getting up warning of dire things that are about to happen. The world is coming to an end. You know, we're all in big trouble. But on the issue of assimilation, I actually find myself one of the few optimists out there. And in fact, the only book that you didn't mention that I wrote, which is probably the most relevant for today, Dr. McDonald, is a book that I wrote in 1991, published in 1991, called Out of the Barrio, Toward a New Politics of Hispanic Assimilation. And it gave a fairly optimistic view of what was happening to the Hispanic population. And, you know, we can talk about immigration generally, but I think if we're really being honest, we are not worried about whether or not Asian immigrants are going to assimilate in the United States. We assume they are. We certainly know that in terms of economic and social indicators, they have assimilated. In fact, they exceed the earnings of American-born, depending on the group. I see Peter Brimelow shaking his head. Depending on the group, Japanese Americans certainly do exceed the earnings of white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. And there are different groups that are assimilating at different rates. But by and large, people are not very worried about Asians. What they are worried about are Latinos. And most specifically, they're worried about Mexicans and, in some parts of the country, Central Americans. And so I'm going to talk a little bit today about what has happened to Hispanics, what is happening to Hispanics in the United States, and what I see as the future of assimilation, because I think assimilation is the real issue. I think one of the things that motivates people most on the immigration question is whether or not the immigrants are changing us, or whether we are going to do what we have done with previous generations of immigrants and change the immigrants. Are they going to become us? Are they going to become Americans? And I think that is the question, and I think it is somewhat of an open question, but not for the reasons that some people who are opposing immigration assume it is an open question, not because so much that there is such a huge difference in today's immigrants, but rather because there is a very big difference in terms of the country that they are immigrating to, the United States, and what it is, how we see ourselves. And of course, Samuel Huntington wrote that in his book. And obviously, with Latinos, you're talking about a huge cohort of immigrants. One-third of all immigrants that have immigrated to the United States over, you know, that are currently living here now, are from one country, from Mexico. That is a huge number. And whether or not we can assimilate that group of immigrants, I think, is the real question. And whether or not we should, in fact, want to assimilate. And that is, in some ways, one of the things that is starkly different about this immigration debate that we're having today and an immigration debate that we would have had in 1924. I mean, it was just automatically assumed in 1924 that immigrants wouldn't assimilate, and there was not, in fact, among the restrictionists, much desire to assimilate those immigrants who had come. And I think at least today there is an open question about whether or not we want to assimilate these newcomers and what we want to assimilate them to. So let me talk for a few moments about Latinos in the United States. There is, you know, in the Latino population, Mexican-Americans, the largest group, about half of the adult population of Mexican origin in the United States are, in fact, recent immigrants. And the vast majority of these are people who have immigrated since 1980. In fact, the numbers who have immigrated since 1990 are exceedingly high. I'm looking here to see what that figure was. I think that the between 1990 and 2000, the immigrants from Latin America actually doubled. So we have this huge population of very, very recent immigrants. And they are different from the rest of us. They come here with, I think, everybody would acknowledge, very low education levels. Half of them have less than a high school education. We're talking about a huge population of people who are undereducated. But we also, if you look at the statistics about Latino immigrants, there are also some indicators that I think ought to give us some hope that there are some factors in terms of these immigrants that should give us cause for optimism. For example, they are more likely to live in two-parent households with a father as the major breadwinner and with children under the age of 18 than other Americans. Now, that is, if we're talking about family values, I think something we can put in the column that is a plus on the side of immigrants. They also come here to work. Now, do they take advantage of a welfare system when they come here? Some do, some don't. Actually, the illegal aliens are less likely to take advantage of the welfare system, since obviously they are underground and are mostly not willing to risk being caught by presenting false papers to the government in order to get aid, although in some cases, because of our law, the interpretation of our 14th Amendment, which says that anybody who has a child on U.S. soil is automatically, that child is automatically a U.S. citizen. Their children are, in fact, everywhere eligible for welfare programs. And the primary welfare program that these children of illegal aliens use, in addition to the education system, is they sometimes get food assistance, mostly through the Women, Infants, and Children program, but some other food programs as well. And they get some medical assistance. So, but that aside, the fact is immigrants come here legally, and those who come here illegally come here primarily to work. And they come here because they are from countries where, even if you are enterprising and willing to work very long and very hard, the likelihood is you're not going to be well remunerated for that, and you will get much greater remuneration if you take the risk of crossing the border illegally, or if you are lucky enough and have a family member able to sponsor you coming legally to the United States. So they are self-selected for being motivated to join the workforce. And in fact, labor force participation rates for Mexican males are extraordinarily high. The last time I looked at this, and it's been a few years since I've looked at those numbers, but the last time I looked at it, labor force participation rates for Mexican males exceeded that for every other group in the country, with one exception, Haitian males, who actually were more likely to be in the workforce than Mexican males. But they have very high labor force participation rates. Now, that is males, not females. Females are much less likely. They actually have lower labor force participation rates than non-Hispanic whites, and that is largely because they're much more traditional, and the mother is more likely to stay at home with her children. They also, Mexican immigrants and other Latin American immigrants, are increasingly likely to own homes. In Los Angeles, some studies have shown that about almost half of the immigrant population, Latin American immigrant population, own homes. So they become property owners here in the United States. And that, by the way, is not divided out by legal versus illegal. Those are lump numbers. And my guess is probably you'd have a higher proportion of home ownership among legal immigrants, since they have the proper documentation to get loans, et cetera. But, you know, these are all factors which I think ought to be put into the plus factor. With respect to one of the areas that I think that causes the most concern, that is language, it's a mixed bag. Mexican immigrants and others from Latin America are less likely to speak English than immigrants from other countries, even non-English speaking countries. And their children, when they go into school, depending on where they happen to go to school, may be less likely to learn English than other immigrant groups. Now, this is in part changing, and it's changing because of some things that took place at the grassroots level in places like California, Arizona, and Massachusetts. Because of a movement to actually getting the voters involved in those states, there were actually initiatives put on the ballot in both Arizona and in California, which replaced the 30-year-old bilingual education program, which, as my friend Michael Barone is fond of saying, is neither bilingual or education, with a program of English immersion. And a lot of the complaint about why is it, you know, these kids aren't learning English has to do with an education system that has prevented them from learning English, at least learning it in the classroom, as previous waves of immigrants did. When we look back on the early part of the 20th century, the public school system in places like Manhattan was a great equalizer. You had immigrants coming in from different parts of the world. They were thrown into a public school system, which was not at all ashamed of the idea that these kids had to learn English, had to learn it immediately. And basically, they could sink or swim. There were no special efforts to give them special help. They simply were expected to learn it almost by osmosis. And they were also expected to learn other things, like learn about American hygiene and learn about American culture and learn to think of George Washington as the father of their country. Well, since the 1960s in the United States, that has not been what Mexican immigrant children have learned in school. They learn that Miguel Hidalgo is the father of their country, and they learn that not in Mexico, they learn it here. And they learn it in Spanish, and they learn lots of other things that have very little to do with American culture. And that has been as a result of policies that were imposed mostly not by even Mexican-Americans, but by left-wing non-Hispanic whites who were part of the New Left movement that pushed multiculturalism. And if there was any group that might be most responsible for the drift toward multicultural education, it was probably African-Americans, whose roots are very deep here in the United States. The move towards multicultural education was primarily an effort to try to appease black nationalists and others who wanted to make up for a history of discrimination and to do it by making blacks learn about a very left-wing version of their history, and that then spread to Latinos and others. So we have a system here where for at least 2 to 3 decades of this huge, massive influx of newcomers into the United States, we as a nation and our institutions as a matter of public policy basically sent a message to newcomers that they shouldn't assimilate, that they should hold on to their culture. And it wasn't just bilingual education or multicultural education, it was also affirmative action programs. You held on to the notion that you were members of a separate and distinct ethnic group because there was an advantage in doing so. When it came time to apply for college, you checked the box and you got in easier with lower grades and lower test scores. And when it came time after you graduated to get your first job, you checked the box and you were more likely to be hired. And once hired, you were more likely to be promoted based on checking that box. Again, a part of an affirmative action policy not motivated because of the presence of so many immigrants and immigrants' children in our nation, but because of the presence of blacks and an attempt to basically to promote a kind of results-oriented equal, not opportunity, but equal results. Well, despite this, if you look at the language proficiency of third generation Hispanics in the United States, what you find is that a majority of Hispanics who've been here at least two generations, whose grandparents were here, speak only one language, and that language is English. They're not even bilingual. Like Italians, Greeks, Poles, Jews, and others before them, they in fact lose their language after the third generation and become English monolingual, which is one of the reasons why, since my family's been here a lot longer than three generations, why it is that I can't converse comfortably with my fellow Mexican-Americans or newcomers in Spanish. The other phenomenon, probably the most encouraging statistic in terms of whether or not Latinos are assimilating in the United States, has to do with intermarriage. And we heard on the last panel that the intermarriage rates were about 40%. Well, the last study that I've seen that looks at figures of intermarriage rates for Mexican Americans, third generation Mexican Americans who are young, who are under the age of 35, suggests that 60% are marrying outside their ethnic group. They're marrying non-Hispanic whites primarily. And I listened as Peter Brimelo talked in the last panel about what's happening demographically to the United States. And we hear this all the time. We hear it from Latinos all the time, that if by the year 2050, whites will no longer be the majority in the United States. And if you look at some statistics, I don't know whether it's 2050 or 2080, but Latinos are going to be the majority population. Well, that's true if you count my grandson, Michael Ambrose, as a Latino. Now, if you were to look at Michael Ambrose, if I had him up here, he's just 2 years old, he's got carrot red hair and green eyes. And that is because his mother, Sandy, her family, she doesn't really know what her family is, but she thinks they're probably Scots-Irish and maybe a little German. My son David is, you know, obviously my son. His father's family came from Poland and Russia. They were Jews. My family, my mother's maiden name is McKenna. She's a blue-eyed blonde, alabaster-skinned, very fair, beautiful woman, whose family were, her father was Irish. His parents came over after the potato famine from Ireland. Her mother's family were mostly English and perhaps a little few Scots-Irish. You know, my father's family, as I said, came in the early 1600s, 1601. Pedro Durrani Chavez came as part of Juan Oñate's expedition to New Mexico in 1601, and the family stayed there from that time. We had some latecomers. They came in 1701. The Armijos came in 1701. So, you know, if you count Michael Ambrose, who has all of those antecedents as Latino, yes, then the United States will be a majority Latino population. But that's like saying we are, you know, a German population, because the single largest ethnic group in the United States today is German. Although apparently the last census showed a huge drop-off of Germans. And it isn't that they all, you know, packed up and left or they all died. It's that Germans are so American now that they don't think to check any boxes when it comes time, and when they're asked what they are, they say they're American. So I am actually fairly sanguine about the demographics and what is happening to Latinos. I think there are a lot of things that could screw it up, and I have to say that when you have a huge influx of people speaking one language and from one country, and you come into a nation which is very unsure about itself and who we are as a people, that assimilation process could be slower than it has been in the past, and I think that's probably likely, and I think that is what upsets a lot of people, is that it doesn't seem to be happening as quickly. Although I think if you look back and read some of the literature from the early 20th century, people were very, very concerned about Jews and Italians and others at that period as well, and they managed to do pretty well. I do think that the real question, the real issue, is defining who we are as a people and what it is we want to transmit. And that motto, which goes back, it's as old as the nation, it goes back to 1776, of E Pluribus Unum, is not, I'm glad Dr. McDonald knows how to translate it and what it means, but Al Gore didn't. During the 2000 election, he was very proud to say E Pluribus Unum means out of one many. And maybe it wasn't a mis, you know, translation. Maybe that's really his vision for America. And I think, unfortunately, that is the vision. That balkanized vision is the vision of much of the left. But I think if we are to be concerned about what is happening to us, what we really need to be concerned is whether or not we, as a people, are confident enough in who we are and what it is we want to transmit to this new generation, that we do so. I think the most telling anecdote that Peter Brimelow told in the last panel was about his son and about the education, what he learns in public school in Connecticut. He does not learn about the roots he doesn't learn about the Civil War and who fought in that war. He does learn a very, very, you know, selective vision of American history. But that's not the fault of, you know, Mexican immigrants coming here. That's the fault of the left and its influence on the education system, about which Peter has written in his book, Worm in the Apple, and about which I wrote in my book, Betrayal. This, I think, is the real issue. And I do believe that E Pluribus Unum ought to be our motto. I do believe that we need to be one nation, that we need to be one people, that we need to have a common language, a common history, and a common culture. But I think it is more incumbent upon us, those of us who have been here, to commit to that again than it is to blame immigrants because they are somehow going to change this. Thank you.